Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It makes you lose faith in the legal system in particular when you see people being, you know, having criminal records for life for possessing a small amount of cannabis or for having an addiction that they cannot manage. It makes people just lose faith.
Over the last few years, it's been pretty consistent that women are dying at a higher rate than men due to drug-related deaths. Why? And why are these figures still going up? This is Stop and Search on the Distraction Pieces Network, brought to you by Acast in association with Elite UK. Let's get to the bottom of this. Here we go. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where true values seldom stray. Thank you so much for joining us. So we're going to be talking to Laurie Penny, who you may have heard on a previous episode. Go check that one out. We talk about her book, The Bitch Doctrine. It's a fantastic episode. Completely unedited, we put that one out because it was just so fun. But we're talking about a different subject matter today, which isn't quite so fun. Women are dying at a higher rate than men, but they use less drugs. So we've got a lot to discuss and work out why this is going on. So we've got Neve Eastwood, who is a friend of mine. She's the executive director of Release, a drugs charity, which I really urge you to check out. Please, they do such amazing work. And we're also joined by Anya Pop, who is a Channel 4 news correspondent. She's covered this issue as well. She's put out films about it. As you know, if you listen to this on the Acast app, acast.com/stopandsearch, there'll be scrolling links underneath with all relevant information. There'll be links to Anya Pop's videos. We're also going to be linking to Release's work and, of course, Laurie Penny's work as well. So let's get straight into this. Why? What's going on? Why are women dying at a higher rate than men? What are we not understanding about this issue? Here we go. There's been some horrific statistics come out lately. There's been a 95% rise in female drug deaths, but women are using less drugs. So why is there this disparity? And there's been a 216% increase in Scotland in drug deaths. So what's going on? All right, so this is going to be what the panel was about. So joining us, we have Laurie Penny.
Hi, I'm Laurie. I'm a writer and a journalist, and I'm mostly here to learn from the rest of you guys.
And also we've got Anya Pop.
Hi, so I'm a journalist at Channel 4 News, and I've made a few pieces recently about drugs and women and drug use. So that's why I'm here, I believe.
And Neve Eastwood.
Hi, I'm Neve Eastwood. I'm Executive Director of Release, which is the UK's Centre of Drugs and Drug Laws. So very happy to talk about drug policy.
And I apologise to Neve in advance because not only is she sharing my sweaty microphone, but she's also got the seat that's like a rodeo. It's just so rickety. I'm surprised I managed to stay on that throughout. So I think we're going to start with you, Neve, on that note for many reasons. What's going on? Why have we got a high rate of drug deaths in women now?
That's a huge question. And actually, I think one that's really unexplored. And I think this is an issue that drug policy, including my own organisation, has really failed on. So I think it's interesting to know, I was at a conference in Budapest in September with about 30 or 40 other women who work in this area who are super, super bright. I exclude myself from that definition. But we were talking about drug policy and how it impacts specifically on women. And we had just been very conscious how so much of our work, and people worked in development issues, they worked on harm reduction, on different legal frameworks to deal with drugs. But the real absence of research around the specific kind of experience of women who use drugs, and in particular, the specific issues around women who use drugs problematically. So, I think earlier you were talking about language and the importance of language to say that, you know, some people do have problems with drugs, but those are generally driven by their own experiences. It's not because of the drugs, it's because often they will have suffered trauma. So physical abuse, sexual abuse, or other pretty awful childhood experiences and adult experiences. And when women go out to seek treatment in this country and many other countries across the globe, and especially women who have children, they are defined as mothers first and people second. So actually accessing treatment, for example, is very difficult because often social services will be brought in basically because you say, I have a child. And so there is an assessment. It's assumed that your child is at risk regardless of assessing whether there is risk or not. And I can talk a little bit more about that if you want. So I think we have this barrier to accessing treatment that we're not properly looking at. I also think that the services, harm reduction services, which are completely diminished in this country, we have moved to a recovery agenda which focuses abstinence as the outcome, the main outcome of treatment, rather than saving people's lives and protecting people's lives and making sure that their lives are better. So we have this barrier to treatment, but also services that are very male-focused and very focused on, I have to say, white straight males. So, I mean, there is not the diversity in services that there needs to be. And I think this is one of the problems that we have. In relation to the drug-related deaths, I don't want to take up too much time, but in relation to the drug-related deaths, you know, I think a lot, like there's the recent reports have been really interesting to see where we've really focused on the fact that women are dying at a huge rate compared to historically, but also to the fact that up until that point, the conversation was very much about older white men dying. It was the train spotting generation. So you saw pictures of, you know, Ewan McGregor and other famous actors who are meant to depict these tragic, tragic deaths. And actually, when you dig behind the statistics, you know, obviously it's a third of the deaths are women, but also too, when we look at the drivers for those deaths, most of them, like with men, are accidental. But if we look at intentional poisoning around illicit, where illicit drugs are part of the death, the rates for intentional poisoning are double that of men. So it's almost double. So it's 22% of female drug-related deaths are intentional compared to 11% of men. And nobody's really questioning what's going on here. And I think it's tied up with like austerity and everything else. So suicide. I mean intentional, so suicide. And I think there's a bigger conversation that we should be having around austerity and, mm-hmm. you know, poverty and all of those things and what's driving it.
Well, obviously there is a huge taboo in terms of talking about suicide and about people who take their own lives, not just around austerity. And it's partly because within journalism itself, there is a very defined set of, you know, internal self-prescribed laws and rules around what you can and can't say in terms of reporting suicide and reporting self-harm. But I actually just wanted to ask you to clarify on people who are seen as mothers first when they're drug users. Are you saying that people who use drugs and are mothers are less likely to seek help because they're worried that their kids will be taken away? And if so, is that the same for men with kids who are users of drugs?
Okay, so I think, again, this is a really interesting point, and this is based on the experience. So at my organisation, we deliver legal services directly in harm reduction and drug treatment centres with people who have a history of problematic crack cocaine and heroin use. And I think, yes, women are in particular defined as mothers first. Mm-hmm. So men are not treated in the same way when they present for treatment in most cases.
They're not treated as fathers first.
So women are defined by their motherhood. Men are defined by their personhood, by being men, mm-hmm. presenting for treatment. But also to race and class play into this. So that's a really important thing. So the majority of people who are accessing treatment are people who are from areas of deprivation, because we know poverty exacerbates problematic drug use. If you are rich and you're middle class or middle class and wealthy, you have resources that mean that you don't have to access community drug treatment in the same way. And then race. So for example, we had a client, and I remember it very well, who was in her late 20s. She had two children who were of school age. The children were going to school. They were doing well, good grades, regular attendance, good friendship groups. She used crack cocaine. She smoked a pipe at night after 10 o'clock once the kids were in bed. She felt that was her choice, that wasn't good for her, you know, and that's tied up with how we report and crack and everything else. She went to services. Her children were immediately put on the at-risk register, which is wrong, because at-risk should be an assessment of harm legally. That's why you put people on the children on the at-risk register. So I think it's tied up with being a female, with class and with race. So
thank you.
I think there's a really good point to bring Anya in on this, because your film picks up on those points of what goes on in the dynamic of parents. If you listen to this podcast, go to acast.com/stop and search and Anya's film will be up there scrolling. Can you just tell us about what your film is about?
So we were given some figures. The University of York had analysed the rate of drug deaths in women in the last 10 years. And as you say, it's gone up by 95% opposed to, I think, 48% in men. So it's still going up for both, but more for women. And it was quite a difficult one for us, because you kind of really want a sort of black and white answer as to what that is. But as Niamh touched on, it's really hard to kind of work out what that is. And the people that we spoke to said it's a mix between women not wanting to expose the fact that they've got a problem with drugs because of the risk of having their children taken off them. We spoke with a lady who had been addicted to heroin for 20 years, and then she'd been clean for a year after her partner died. And she said that often in cases of partners where they're both doing drugs, they feel that only one of them can ask for help, and the other one has to kind of stay in the shadows, as she put it. So her partner sought help, and she had to kind of carry on with her addiction, didn't want to expose that they both had a problem with drugs. And also touching on what you were saying about austerity, a lot of the people that we spoke to were saying that obviously in times of austerity they try and simplify drug treatment centres. And so as a result of this, it's kind of, you know, men on the whole are the ones that use drugs more and have more issues with drugs, and therefore obviously it's catered towards men. And that means women who are drug addicts, who have often are survivors of rape or domestic abuse, kind of, you know, they go into these centres which are full of men, often who know their partners or know the people who have perpetrated the crime against them, and feel they can't get the help they need there because they're being judged, or you know, things will get back to their partner. So it's not a very clear picture from what we could work out, and quite depressing in many ways that we've got to this point.
And that's quite a theme in your book, isn't it, Laurie, of, as you just said there, women are often seen as mothers first before a bit becoming a person. And this is a completely broad issue of that, isn't it? That it's there. We're treating drug consumers as mothers and not people in their own right.
Absolutely, and it's very similar to the way in which issues that specifically affect women's health have been minimised throughout, you know, the history of medicine. Even now, when it comes to the way that that medicinal drugs and medicines are administered, people sometimes, you know, make mistakes, because a lot of the idea is that these things are standardized to a standard body, which is assumed to be male. There is still very little research on specific health issues that affect that either affect women more than men, apart from things like breast cancer, or the ways that common medical problems that affect everyone affect women differently. And a lot of women's specific problems for people with uteruses and female reproductive systems, have been ignored for many, many years. Only recently has the treatment of endometriosis, just for an example, been taken seriously. Endometriosis is a disease which is reasonably common, where you have the same cells that make up the walls of the uterus migrate around the body so that when you have your menstrual cycle, there is bleeding from those cells in disparate parts of the body. And it's incredibly debilitating, but it's also very hard to diagnose because doctors don't know what they're looking for because they're not taught to look for it. So a lot of women who will present with terrible, crippling pain for years sometimes are told that they're making it all up. And I feel that when we're talking about women's health, there are a lot of similarities here in what both of you are saying about the research you've done around drug policy.
Especially as well, the differences between physical pain and emotional pain mm-hmm. being the same thing as well. And that's something your film touches on, isn't it, Anya, that you use a case study of Veronica, that her parents were consuming heroin, especially even at her own wedding, presumably to treat emotional pain that's going on in their lives. Do you think that we're any closer to understanding that and grasping that and treating that on its own merits?
The emotional pain? No, I think we're going forward in understanding drug addiction. But I think also what you're saying about Veronica, there's so many different levels to addiction, isn't there? Often addiction goes in generations. So families kind of who bring their children up in an environment where there's lots of drug taking, the children kind of go on to drug take. Veronica wasn't one of those. Veronica grew up with parents who sold drugs and consumed heroin in the house. She's amazing. She's got, she moved away and her mum died at the age of 56, I think, of drug addiction. She died of hepatitis C. Well, she died of liver cancer as a result of hepatitis C. And that's something in the stats as well, that women, older women, are dying as a result of their drug addiction, which is interesting. But yeah, in terms of the emotional, I just think in times of austerity, they kind of treat the sort of the main issue and don't look around the kind of corner. And I guess if those things were treated first, then perhaps people wouldn't get addicted to drugs.
That must be something that you see in release all the time, because you're at the front line. People come to you when they're in turmoil. So it must be really difficult in your line of work to see this emotional trauma that's out there.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's incredibly hard to see. I have to say, I no longer deliver the legal services. It's my amazing legal team who are out every day dealing with that. But I think what's really important to remember that the clients that we see, it's not about the drugs, and yet the policy, both treatment and criminal justice, obsess about the drugs. So rather than saying, well, why is this person using heroin? And think about what heroin is. Heroin is diamorphine. It's illegal street diamorphine. That's it. We use diamorphine in hospitals every day to treat pain, every single day to treat physical pain. It is perfectly rational that someone who is emotionally in pain seeks out a substance to relieve that pain. That is a rational choice. Yet we treat people who use these substances as completely irrational. We then define them by their drug use and say that the treatment has to focus on getting them free of that drug, rather than looking at, well, what's going on around? What's the cause of this? Let's look at the social issues that are going on. Often extreme poverty, which I say is exacerbates their experiences. So there are middle class and upper class people who use heroin. It is not just within people who live on benefits, for example, or who are very low incomes. This is common amongst society. The difference is these people are visible to us because of deprivation. Yeah, so we need to start addressing those issues. Job opportunities. In Portugal in 2001, they decriminalized drug possession. So they ended criminal sanctions for drug use and drug consumption. In this country, we still decide to criminalize people who have suffered in the way that I'm describing and those who choose to use recreationally. But what they also did in Portugal, they recognized the need for a really holistic approach. So they set up employment programs. They went to employers and said, you know what, you hire the guys who are in our clinic, we'll pay half their wage. They give microloans to people to set up companies, recognizing that deprivation is the exacerbator here. And that if we really want to treat the problem, one, we look at the cause of it, not the drug. And what we do is we make sure that that person has some, that has better social and economic capital than they currently have. Also too, when I say treat the problem, treating the problem means respecting what the individual wants, not what you as the treatment service dictates to them. So at the moment, we have a very punitive treatment service where our clients are infantilized, treated as children, who can't make their own decisions, who have to jump through hoops in order to get their medication. And that is no treatment environment. A proper treatment environment is where the clinical needs of the patient are addressed. So treatment here is defined as being drug-free, rather than saying what proper treatment is the quality of your life. Is saying, okay, if you need to be on a methadone script for 20 years, that's fine. You know, if someone has diabetes and they go off and binge on chocolate, we wouldn't think for a moment of taking away their insulin. That would be cruel, but we do that in treatment services in the UK every single day.
What was the line that the Home Office, I mean, both Neve and Anya will know this, but the response of the Home Office when the figures were unearthed of 95% increase in drug deaths, what was it?
I'm not sure they recognise them, actually. I'm not sure that we... I'm not sure they ever commented on them.
I think, Neve, you probably know, wouldn't you? It's...
I don't know if they commented on your report, which was brilliant, by the way, I have to say. I'm not sure they comment on that, but generally speaking, the line from the Home Office is drug policy is working in this country, drug use is falling. They define a successful drug policy by prevalence rather than harms. So for me, I don't care if a million more people are smoking cannabis a year, if it is causing no harm, really. I do care if one more person dies as a result of shitty drug policies and shitty drug laws. So, you know, that's what matters.
And actually, drug use has gone up very slightly in the years since 2010, when the Conservative coalition started. So in the last 10 years, when drug deaths in women have gone up exponentially, that's obviously 10 years, but then in the 7 years since we had a change of government, I mean, it hasn't been great for ages, but it's gone up.
No, you're absolutely right. So that statement they make about drug use falling is actually around cannabis use specifically.
Yeah.
And it's between 2002 and 2010 when we had reclassification of cannabis and brought the penalties down. So it's got nothing to do with this government, even though they lay claim to it.
In Laurie's book, again, I'll keep quoting it, but it's fantastic. And actually it's in this New Statesman article that you put out of... People have to believe in the government, just as the same as it's almost a parental relationship, mm-hmm. where we have to have faith in our parents, the goals they set for us, the morals they set for us, and the punishments that they give us. We've got that same relationship with the government. You know, we're essentially in servitude to them. You know, it was a bad choice of word, but do you think that drug laws are the absolute example of how the government get it wrong and how that loses respect from citizen state?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way that drug use is criminalised and punished in this country as well as in the United States is just a classic example of everybody knows that this is crazy. Everybody knows that it's not working, including people who don't use drugs themselves. It's common knowledge that drug policy is really, really is wrong. and needs to be rethought. But to watch successive governments sticking to their guns and actually cracking down harder, it's like watching your parents mess up. It's like being punished as a child for something you didn't do. It makes you lose respect for that authority figure. It's really, I think it's damaging to the fabric of our democracy. And it makes you lose faith in the legal system in particular when you see people being, you know, having criminal records for life for possessing a small amount of cannabis or for having an addiction that they cannot manage. It makes people just lose faith. Not that I'm an anarchist. I'm not necessarily wedded to the idea of that, you know, everyone should have faith in the state. But I do believe that faith in any state has to be earned. And this government, like the one before it, like the coalition, is acting like it deserves our faith and our trust without having done anything to earn it.
And I think a good example of that, going back to you, Anya, is your film on drug testing, which is previous to the one that's just been released on drug deaths, of how society itself started to almost police itself. It's broken away from what the state sets out as morals, and the Loop, who drug test, who Henry's normally here, Henry Fisher from Vault Fast and the Loop. It's an issue that's really interesting, isn't it, that drug testing has been quite organic. People have taken it upon themselves to get out there and do that. You interviewed a lot of people in festival scenes. What was the general reaction like? Were people for, against?
I mean, I think we couldn't find anyone that was against it.
Not at all?
No. Yeah, so the piece was about drug testing at festivals. So it's a microcosm of what could happen.
So what are they testing for?
So they're testing for the danger, the strength, and basically that it is what you think it is. So the idea is you can go up, you can give them... They can't give you back, which one woman who didn't realise this and gave them all of her drugs was very disgruntled to find out. But we couldn't film that, unfortunately. So you give a bit of whatever you want testing and then go back in an hour, and then you have a sort of consultation with them, and they tell you about what you've got, how strong it is, if it is what you think it is, and give you advice on it. You know, they can advise you not to take it, but generally they'll, that's only if it's really dangerous, generally they'll just say you should do X amount of it, and, you know, it's drug safety, basically. And they found loads of stuff. So they found ecstasy pills, which were concrete. They found ketamine that was anti-malarial tablets. They found all sorts of stuff. I mean, not stuff that you'd take willingly. But I mean, it's interesting because this was for recreational drug users rather than people that have got an issue with drugs. I don't know if that's the correct terminology, problem with drugs. Obviously, as Channel 4 News, national broadcaster, regulated by Ofcom, we couldn't put people on drugs on the TV, which made for quite interesting vox pops. So we spoke to a few people who I, you know, suspected were probably on drugs. And they're like, no, it's fine. And they were admitting they were doing drugs. And I was like, well, you know, do your parents need it? Yeah, my parents know I do drugs. Do your work need it? Yeah, my work knows I do drugs. I'm like, right, okay. So we'd interview them, and I'd give them a card and say, look, if you change your mind, let me know. They all let me know. Within about an hour, like, oh, yeah, I'm not sure that's a great idea. About what we said. So we spoke to four people, and they all, I think, probably had, maybe, actually, I shouldn't say this. Anyway, so they were, I said to them all, look, if you want to make it clear that you don't do drugs, you need to say, we don't do drugs. So all of them looked very suspicious, because they're like, well, I don't do drugs, but my friends. we couldn't find anyone. Like, obviously, you want to reflect kind of the different arguments, but, you know, at a festival, generally, people are quite sort of open to the idea that some people will take drugs, even if they don't do it themselves.
I'm just thinking of that Brass Eye episode now. It's in my head.
I don't think I've seen that one.
The cake episode.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
It's wonderful. But the bit where they can't find... There is some statistic that's made up as, like, 25% of 15-year-olds are on hard drugs. We couldn't find any 15-year-olds, so instead of asking 3 15-year-olds, we're asking 9 5-year-olds. You want drugs? Do you use the horse? You know, do you shoot up? It's like, no.
That's a really good point, because that's something I really want to touch on, is how the media does deal with drugs. Because there's a great article that came out in Vice, and as much as I probably shouldn't say her name, Katie Hopkins, it says about the dangers of journalism that... Yeah, the dangers of Katie Hopkins. Say no to Katie
Just
Hopkins.
Just say no.
Because yeah. that she should be classified, I think.
Use responsibly.
But it's the dangers of balance, of how things are reported. Mm. So, and you draw examples in the book again, Laurie, of you had a debate on Channel 4 News, believe it or not. And the way that things are constructed is you know, jousting, it's adversarial. As opposed to having a conversation, you have to pick a side and then fight that. And if you've got too much balance over one way, prime example, drug policy, the evidence is in our favour. We've won the debate.
Yeah, absolutely. But the idea of balance, is that you get two people who disagree about everything and you make them shout at each other for 5 minutes and that's balance. Well, it's like, it's really hard for broadcasters, I do understand, because they have to, well... They have to not be Fox News. There is the duty to actually provide some sort of objectivity. And you have to do that whilst also making interesting television in some sort of way. So occasionally wanting people to have a fight, that does sometimes produce... It doesn't produce a workable conversation, but sometimes it does cover your bases and give you 5 minutes of interesting TV. But in terms of debating the issues, it's not necessarily always... helpful. It's sometimes much more interesting to have people who disagree slightly to talk about the bits that they might agree on or not. I don't know, you probably have a lot to say about this.
Yeah, I feel like we've angled in on Anya now. I really apologise.
Gotta run. Yeah, I mean, I guess with a debate, what we're trying to do is show the different arguments. Mm. And sometimes we have to do... I mean, sometimes people are really opposed to each other. We will try not to construct an argument, but at the same time, you don't want people that are nuanced, because then you're not really doing justice to the debate. And some debates as well, like, make us feel a little bit, I don't know, uncomfortable, maybe. But there are debates that are happening in wider society, and so you have to have them. Even if you think that maybe the debate hasn't got base, if that is a debate that's happening... then as a public broadcaster, we have a responsibility to reflect that. But I do agree, like, sometimes those kind of shouty... I mean, we've had guests before where we've had to put them in different rooms before, and that's...
Really?
Like, yeah, I mean, often environmental kind of debates. But, I mean, I don't know. Nobody likes anyone that's shouting, but at the same time, if they agree with each other, it's kind of a bit boring.
From our side, Neve, being in drug policy reform, there's the usual characters that get wheeled out, isn't there? And it turns into a shouting match. And that's why on this podcast we don't construct it in a adversarial way. We find that the audience prefer it having a conversation. I think that's why podcasts work. People like being a voyeur on a conversation. But we do. We get them in drug policy, don't we, where it's just shouting matches and it's the same figures every time. Whereas the reform side, so many big characters you can have on there. Yourself, someone from Leap, someone from Transform, Nigel over here who we're going to speak to. Totally, we're going to get to you. But on the other side, you get the shouty matches. I use Katie Hopkins as an example. She has spoken on drug policy before. But how do we get around that? How do we actually get this down to a conversational point again?
Well, to be very frank, I was getting very frustrated going on shows and having these adversarial conversations. And I think it's also a responsibility of how you handle it. So I think if you end up shouting, you're doing a disservice to the audience. And I'm not perfect at it. I've ended up shouting, so I know this. But equally too, and this is going completely off topic, but, you know, last week with Trump going after the press again and saying, when will balance be brought back? You know, when is there going to be balance? And it was actually Reagan who got rid of the duty of the press to have an objective debate. So whilst we may not like it, as long as we have those, we don't end up with Fox News here to the same degree. So I think, you know, I think it's more nuanced than kind of like we shouldn't shout each other. I would like a more constructive, thoughtful debate. I would like Peter Hitchens to be banned from everything, as well as Katie Hopkins. But I don't believe in prohibition, so you know. So I think it's really hard for the media. I do think it's hard, but I also think our side comes on with evidence. You know, so we have our emotional arguments, but we also back it up every single time with evidence. And that's all you can try to do. My favorite line, though, is, you know, that the fact that we are a well-funded, you know, billion-dollar campaign behind all our organizations. You can all look at our accounts. We're not. But also, too, what do you think prohibition is? My God, that's the most well-funded campaign. 100 years of governments across the world feeding money into it. And you're talking about us getting, you know, a grant from George Soros or someone like that. It's ridiculous. There is no parody in this.
I was just going to say, I'm still waiting on my check from George Soros.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, it's in the mail.
It must be difficult from a media point of view, Anya, to put out a balanced piece because, as you said, unless you go for the same characters on drug policy specifically that are always out there and always shouting, there's not a lot else you can do other than just covering the stories. And I think that's why your pieces have been so great, and not just saying it because you're in front of me, but your pieces have been balanced and nuanced and haven't had to bring in that adversarial point of view. You've just covered a story, haven't you?
Yeah, although I have to admit, after one of the pieces, we did have a debate with Peter Hitchens. Sorry, I had nothing to do with it, though.
I'm sorry for you.
I had nothing to do with it. I mean, as I was mentioned earlier, we have got a duty to do the balance. And there are people out there that think it is wrong that we'd even consider sort of, you know, legalising marijuana or testing drugs at festivals or any of these things. There is an argument, and we have to represent that argument. But at the same time, we aren't interested in having a shouting match as much as you might think. We're interested in having an actual debate where people are like sort of desperate to get their word out because there is so much to say and they feel so passionately about it, not so much about the shouting. But I mean, we talk about austerity, but you know, the news media is going through a huge time of change and budgets are being cut and we've got less and less staff. And unless, you know, we have, you know, there's less people sort of guest booking, for example, and sometimes it's just a lack of time and a lack of knowledge of who the best people are. And we're constantly finding new people to come on the programme. But, you know, you don't want to bring out the same people for the same debate. And, you know, I know we've used Peter Hitchens a couple of times, but...
But I think it's a real problem for you. There literally is three people who argue the other side.
Yeah.
You know, so you have a limited pool.
And a lot of them want paying as well. A lot of the kind of prohibition people, and
really?
We don't have a budget.
Oh my God!
Well funded.
Not so much. Not just with drugs. A lot of people that are having that adverse point of view.
Professional contrarians.
Well, not so much professional contrarians, but they know that there's not many people that be willing to put themselves on the line to say those things because they know there'll be loads of hit back on Twitter and stuff, and so. You know, and we just haven't got the funds for that either, so.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Isn't that interesting, though, that the people that are objecting against drug law reform are the ones getting the aggro now? Because you would think it'd be the people trying to reform the drug laws because, you know, we're creating hedonism. We create this stupid universe where people are just losing their squash on drugs all the time. But it's not, is it? We're actually almost going back to the Rebel Alliance. We're the Rebel Alliance. We seem to be the goodies in this.
Yeah. It's also the new right wing and people who do a lot of online harassment. They seem to be pretty into drugs. Like, they seem to be pretty against prohibition for various reasons I'm not sure I would want to speculate about. Huh? Yeah, a lot of them are libertarians. Yeah, and libertarians tend to be pretty keen on legalizing drugs across the board. Not so much legalizing abortion; they stop there for some reason. but they're all right. They're on that. A stop clock tells the right time twice a day.
Do you think we can ever have that conversation of sovereignty over your own body, no matter what the subject matter is? Do you think that we're getting to grips with the fact that a person is a person and they can have agency?
Oh God, not yet. No, I think it's getting worse. Yeah. On lots and lots of different levels, the idea that a human being has a right to control what happens to their body is becoming more controversial, particularly if that human being is not a white, straight, male human being. It's often, particularly in libertarian circles, that that conversation stops at somebody's right to not pay taxes, own a gun, and smoke weed. But actually, there are a lot of different kinds of agency and bodily autonomy that are not discussed at all in those terms. Abortion being one of them, different kinds of drug use being another. It's not talked about in terms of agency and consent.
It must be difficult to present these cases in terms that are specifically talking about our region and your Middle England friendly, because these are difficult subject matters to address. How do you go about researching something like drug policy to put it out on daytime TV, evening TV?
I should add, I am from Middle England. I'm from the Midlands. But yeah, there are lots of people who don't see it from a kind of, I guess, a London-centric point of view that's quite sort of liberal. But in terms of how we research, I guess with all, you know, Channel 4 News especially is really interested in drug policy and drug laws and drug reform and all of that. But it's how we tell the story in a different way, because we can't keep telling the same stories. It's not interesting. So it's quite hard sometimes to keep these issues that we really think are important on the agenda, you know, domestic abuse and kind of, I guess, the stories which are harder to tell in a way. So it's basically always trying to find a new angle or a new stat or and keeping in touch with people who are in that industry or are in that field and can sort of share updates and changes that are happening.
Do you think we're getting better, Niamh, at the way that drug policy is presented? Do you think that we are reaching out there into the other realms that we've not necessarily touched before?
Another good question. You were talking about social media earlier, and I do worry sometimes that we do work in an echo chamber in social media and drug policy, and that we put a lot of effort into this, and we're just repeating the same kind of line to the people who already support us. So I would question like the value of really focusing that unless you're getting out there and beyond that echo chamber. I think what we're doing well is, if you look at 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this was not a legitimate debate in many ways. People going on TV and talking about legalization or decriminalization were seen as kind of people who just wanted to use drugs for their own purposes. And there was a real disregard for the social injustices caused by the drug laws. I think that's changed dramatically in the last 7 years. I think one of the major contributions to that is the Global Commission on Drug Policy, where you have all these very high-profiled ex-presidents. They are ex, and that is a problem, and that's mm-hmm. a whole other debate, but they are ex-presidents. But also, you know, high-profile people like Kofi Annan and Richard Branson coming out and saying this is an issue and we should be working on this issue. And I think as we've seen an increase in the kind of social damage caused by drug policies. So Laurie earlier mentioned about how the laws, how people don't respect the law. I think that's really reinforced by the fact that we have, you know, the previous Prime Minister, the previous Chancellor, the current Home or the current Foreign Secretary have all admitted to drug use, and had they been caught, would not be in the positions that they are today. That would have been a blessing, especially in relation to Boris, but, you know, hey. But it's the fact that the law is specifically applied against certain groups. It's about the fact that people are now starting to see that this is a tool of social control, that yep. this is a way of repressing groups in society who are not seen as part of mainstream society, whether that be people of colour, and I should say children of colour, because that's who we focus our drug laws against. We talk about, politicians talk about drug laws being used to protect children, that we have to send the right messages. But if we look at who's being criminalized, these are young black men and young white boys living in deprived areas. So there's an issue of social control, first of all. But more than that, I think that people are a little bit fed up with the hypocrisy of politicians, not just because they've previously used it, but if we look at, for example, the Home Office, their own reports, and there's several of them, but I'll take the most recent one, which was an evaluation of the 2010 drug strategy. So the 2017 drug strategy came out this year. Alongside it, which none of us in drug policy reform saw for about 2 weeks, and then we all went, oh my bloody God. Is an evaluation of the previous strategy. Chapter 5 of that deals with law enforcement. And what it says is, we spend, this is the Home Office, we spend $1.6 billion a year on law enforcement, and it has no to little impact on the supply side. And any impact that it has is short-lived. But what it does have are all of these unintended consequences, these negative consequences. So what's even worse is they know it's not working. They literally know they're pissing $1.6 billion down the drain every year. And they continue to do it. And I think that hypocrisy, both as users of drugs and as purveyors of prohibition, is starting to get a spotlight on it. And I think people are waking it up. I'm not sure it's getting outside of our echo chambers hard enough and fast enough, but who knows?
I'm going to come over to Emily over here, if that's all right, because Emily writes for Vice, Independent, and along with other things. So you're really embedded in the media, aren't you, Emily? And you wrote a piece on the drug death rise, and you used the case study, didn't you, of... And I think this is something that we've touched upon in many of our podcasts, and I think Niamh would definitely agree with this, is it's the human interest that's starting to get people's attention. We can talk about statistics all we want, but unless it's got a face to it, we're just not attaching ourselves there. So can you just give us a bit of a background on what Anne's story was?
Well, much like you said earlier, the link between abuse is like central to this story. So she was only 13 years old when she was raped. And so she didn't turn to drugs immediately, but when she went to do statements, she was saying that she would be in the police station doing a statement, and then there was never any ask, do you need any support? And so eventually she decided to run away from home, and which was a nice home, a nice family who supported her, but she had this huge shame attached to this rape, which was not her fault at all, but for some reason women do have this because of how they're treated. I mean, look at how the questions they're asked in court when they go for rape trials. And so she had this huge shame attached to it and ran away from home and was taken in by, I think, is some kind of grooming gang, which obviously has been talked about quite a lot recently. And she eventually started using drugs and to support that habit with no financial income. When you're 14 years old, you don't have any access to benefits. You don't have a house. There's no support. So to support herself, she started selling drugs. And things just spiraled from there. And the story is quite scary because there's one particular element where she was in a flat which was used for where the drugs were held, that kind of thing. And a rival drug gang had found out and they'd broken in. And she was a child. She hid in a wardrobe. And she could see that they had guns with them as well. And she was fine, she escaped from there. But she was actually later arrested because the police instead found the drugs. So she was hit with a criminal conviction then. And so that was 11 years ago. And she is this, well, it's actually so many horrible things, but there's many abusive relationships because she kind of fell into this pattern of staying with drug dealers, drug users, and a lot of them were abusive. And she's had three children now, and all three of them have been taken away. And that has made her just decline further and relapse so many times. She has twice been on a methadone prescription. But again, like nothing you said about men being, predominantly service users. So like for every one woman, there is three men in services. And so she encountered one ex-partner who was really violent towards her, so she ended up in a refuge, encountered him at a drug service place. And then since the article was published, I've spoken to her, and twice she's encountered him once more and another person again. And my article was published, that one in particular was published 2 weeks ago. And that's three times. And unfortunately, it's, I don't see any end in sight to the story at the moment because it's just, there's no support. When the children were taken away, the children were taken because she's a mother, but her as a person was just left. There was no support there. Her family have really stood by her through all of this, and there was still no proper support. And the whole, even dealing with those issues at the very first, like what sparked this whole decline of a person, has never been tackled. And that's why I just really struggle to see the end, because punishment is what women tend to get in this kind of situation rather than support.
And you spoke to Ian Hamilton, who's a friend of ours. I think he was the one that brought this out in the University of York, the death figures. What was his point of view? Why does he think that we've got a rise, and how do we combat this?
I don't know if I can answer exactly how you'd combat it, but he said that the rise is, well, he thinks it's mainly due to an absence of support. And he also is quite critical of the government for using the same old line of an ageing, cohort of drug users because they are more susceptible to deaths, which they are. There are more deaths among older people, but there are still deaths among young people. And, those people are going to end up being the older people eventually who will, be that person. I don't think I really, like I said, find an answer. But then there are, Agenda is another charity who are really keen for gender-specific services, which I think would definitely go some way towards helping, that. And again, Anyone's Child as well was another one who I included in the article. Their gender-specific services are really important, but the problem is, as the government spends so much more money enforcing drug laws, and the cuts, 16% I think it was, across England in drug services in 4 years, that money is not being ploughed into enforcement, enforcing the drug laws, as opposed to dealing with the problems that start the drug use in the first place and how people come to a self-addiction, basically.
I'm going to come back to Emily in a bit. Can we have a round of applause for that? I kind of dropped it on Emily that we was going to come over to her, so thank you so much for doing that. And that is the line we get from the Home Office, isn't it? There's an ageing cohort that's now
being... Ageing is
40 to 45, and as someone who's in her 40s, I'm offended. No, seriously, I mean, that's what they mean by an aging population. That's it. That people in their 40s are dying, and it's because they're old. That's just offensive.
I don't understand how that's a line either. It's, if there's death of any cohort, then surely that's something that we need to address. It's not like... Oh, I see. But that it is. I think it's those stories, those real tangible hitting stories that are going to sell this issue to reform. And this is something that you said, Laurie, in the past, that you've almost taken a step back now of reactive journalism. You like to sit back, contemplate, and put stuff out there that's more considered, more reasoned, and more humanistic. Do you think that is the best way that we can deal with this in this movement?
Not necessarily, actually. I think obviously there's a place for long-form storytelling. That always makes an impact. But the fight to keep this agenda in the news is also really, really important. When it's a case of just changing the tide of the debate, it's as important to have a volume of stories and a volume of people working on it. It's quantity as much as quality, I think, in this stuff. Although, obviously, incredibly hard-hitting long-form stories are irreplaceable in terms of changing the narrative. It's also about how much it's kept on the agenda.
It's interesting listening to Emily's story that she reported in Vice and the story that you used in the Channel 4 film of Veronica. It's two different sides of the coin, isn't it? You've got the mother and the daughter both having seen drug addiction from the perspectives. What was it like dealing with Veronica? And because I think she got a book out as well, hasn't she?
Yeah, she has. Hidden Harm, it's called. Well, we did a... The problem we have in TV is that I suspect you probably don't have in print. I don't know if yours was a video. Okay, print, yeah. Is that... people often don't want to be in vision. So we spoke with a lady called Trudy as well, who is anonymous. Her story was really powerful, but it's quite hard to kind of tell people's story and let it have the impact that it deserves when you can't actually, you know, see the person. So that's an issue that we have in news, and that's why we kind of spoke with two different sides to try and... I guess, show how, you know, drug laws, drug deaths affect sort of different people. I've forgotten what your question was.
Sorry. But we're going to take a quick sort of, not intermission, but we're going to say goodbye to Laurie in a minute. So is there anybody that's got a specific question for Laurie, or if you want a book signed to get that in quick, or are we okay? Anybody got a hand up there? No, Laurie, why does no one want to ask you a question? Jeez, yeah, go on Twitter and ask that. Yeah, that's it. You need to stoke it up a bit. That's what it is. So if you could give a massive round of applause.
Thank you very much.
To Laurie Penny. And then I think we're going to do about another 10 minutes, if that's all right with you guys. Where did we get to? All right, so basically we need to work out now of what do we do from this point? How do we actually start solving the riddle of some of these drug deaths? Is there a solution? Is there an answer? We keep revisiting the issue of frontline services. Is that the point where we need to get to?
You keep asking big questions. So I think what Laurie just said about the media is really important. Really important, because I think the majority of these deaths, especially the heroin and morphine related deaths, if you look at the profile of people who are dying, the reason the government doesn't care is because of who's dying. These are people who have said repeatedly, live in poverty, have no social political capital, aren't probably going to vote, might do, but they don't care. So when the media, BBC and Channel 4 News, which have started to pay a lot of attention to this in the last month, are highlighting it, it matters. It's giving voice to the issue. The answer? God, drug treatment services have been decimated in this country through funding. They've been decimated through ideology, where, as I've said, the recovery agenda is the dominant agenda, where good treatment is defined by people exiting from treatment based on the drug that they present it with, not even being drug-free, which is not important, actually. But for example, if you're a heroin user, if you enter treatment and you get off heroin but you're using alcohol, that's okay. That's successful, isn't it, in some treatment services? And actually, alcohol is really, really, really bad for you if you've got hepatitis C. Really bad for you. You'd be way better on the heroin, way better. It may kill you quite quickly. So you mean there's this really screwed up treatment system that's not looking at the primary needs of the individual, and those primary needs is to keep them safe, to keep them well, and to improve their lives, and to help them get to a place where they feel that they're stable. And that's defined by the individual and not by some bullshit ideology around abstinence. So I think that's really, really fundamentally important. And we have lost that so much in drug treatment over the last 7 years. The big one, you have to stop criminalizing people who use drugs. Stop treating them as criminals just because they put a substance, and most of those substances come from plants, in their body. That is ridiculous. That is not the role of the state. And when the state talks about the morality of drugs, the morality of drug use, I would question the morality of criminalizing some of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged in society. And thank you, Andrea. And also, too, I would question why they do this. Because you know why? Because othering works really, really well. And this is a group who are othered in society. So if your estate is shitty and your estate has lots of crime on it and there's visible, that's not our fault as government. You know what? It's not, you know, because of Thatcher's policies or whatever. That's because of the people in your estate. It's the drug users. It's the migrants who are taking away your jobs. It's all, you know. That suits government agenda, and you have to start calling it out, because this isn't really about drugs, as I keep saying. It's about structural poverty. It's about structural racism. It's about the failure of the state to actually do its job, to do its job and to do it properly. And its first job is to protect the lives of its citizens, and then its second job is to improve those bloody lives. And that's where we need to push the debate. So we should stop talking about drugs a bit. That would be my answer.
That is so true. Even though we're a drugs podcast, we shouldn't talk about the drugs. It is the people. And that's certainly something, again, Emily, your story with Anne in Vice, and again, I totally recommend people look that up. But we mentioned decriminalisation, as you just said as well. Jane Slater from Transform is quoted in your article. She says about decriminalisation, doesn't she? Can you explain the point that she was making?
Well, I think I kind of touched on it earlier, which was about the money that it's that it consumes, basically, for, you know, the government and for law enforcement to action, you know, the drug laws, and that money could be better spent on services that support people instead, rather than you know enforcing it.
Do you think there's a stigmatisation that inherently goes with criminalisation as well, that all the while we're under that banner, we just can't think of it in terms of anything else than a criminal issue?
Yes, definitely. I mean, addiction is an illness, and I mean, I don't know, disease sounds a bit extreme, I don't know what you think, Lee, but I mean, it does take hold of somebody in the same way as an illness does, and so you do have the stigmatisation, and, you know, once you've got that, it's very hard to lose that, I guess. And it also means that people find it harder to recover because it's accessing support outside of this very small world that you're in when you're in the drug world, I guess. And this is another thing that Anne said to me was, you know, one of her comments was like, you're in such a world. And it is a world in itself. And once you've got that stigma attached to you that you are a drug user and a criminal, you know, a lot of people won't want to spend time with you, and they don't feel that they, you know, not everyone, this is a generalisation, but you know, find it hard to support people who are using drugs as they believe they are criminals, as opposed to somebody who needs support and, you know, just helping to, you know, recover.
And you covered for The Independent the fact that Scotland are facing an even worse drug death rate. I think it's 216% that it's gone up by. What's happening there?
I can't tell you what's happening there, but again, the response from the government was the ageing users. But I have to say, Scotland, Aileen Campbell did come back and said that she has commissioned work. I don't know exactly what this work is, to look into why more women are dying and, you know, how this can be tackled. But, I mean, this is, you know, a very small line, and what this actually means in practice, I don't know yet. So I guess that's a small recognition of what is happening here. But, you know, 216%, you know, increase in women's drug deaths, 77% men, that problem needs to be looked at and tackled quickly. It's, you know, it's not okay just to leave it and ignore it. So there is a small recognition. Similarly, in the government strategy in 2017, the July one that came out, the government did mention, acknowledge that women have a problem. But, I mean, agenda has, you know, they were quite, were pleased, I guess, and they welcomed it. But the line was something like they are going to use innovative approaches to look at perpetrators and victims to essentially reduce the crimes and the misuse of drugs. But again, there's no explanation of what it needs. It was a very small section in the strategy. And I mean, if I was in that position as a woman who's struggling, I'd find that quite insulting. It's almost as obnoxious as Strong and Steady. It really is. So.
Thank you so much again, Emily, for that, because we did drop it on you somewhat today, so thank you so much for that. Right, you lot, there's got to be a question. I'm not going to have an event without there not being a single question. Most times, all the hands going, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to totally... Oh, we got one from Tyler at the back. Thank you, friends, for rescuing me. I'm going to just ignore you as I walk by Nigel, because you've let me down. Tyler, thank you so much.
No problem. Hi, Neem. So, with cannabis not linked to any deaths... Do you see it as separate from the rest of the drug legalisation debate?
So, because cannabis isn't any responsible for any...
Any deaths, basically. Yeah, it's not dangerous in the same way as other drugs. So should it be a separate argument or...
No, I think we should legalise all drugs. That should be the ultimate goal. Our organisation firstly starts with decriminalisation, which I know lots of the cannabis legalisation movement aren't fond of. But the reason that we do that is very pragmatic, is that we work with people who use all drugs. And so we want a policy that benefits all of them first. And then we start to look at cannabis legalization. So are you saying that in terms like the drug-related deaths could be used as an argument for cannabis legalization?
Yeah, basically.
So yeah. That is actually interesting, because there's a lot of research coming out of the US, which you all probably know has a huge opioid crisis with very high rates of drug-related deaths, far exceeding ours. And there's some research from the states that have regulated cannabis both for recreational purposes and for medicinal purposes, that there's lower rates of deaths in those states. It's an interesting argument, and I think that's a good reason why we should move. One good reason why we should move to cannabis regulation. But I get concerned when we start to pit drugs against each other. I don't think that's helpful. I think we should be working all together, all drug users, and saying policies failed. Let's look at solutions. So that's my answer to it.
And I think that there's a good point there. Excuse me, a good point there that we are strangely almost angled to reform the way that we deal with heroin over cannabis first, aren't we? With drug consumption rules, heroin-assisted treatment. Do you reckon the public are getting that message better than they are with broader drug policy reform and cannabis?
I don't think the public have been very involved in those messages. I think those have been taken by very strong harm reduction advocacy groups in, for example, Glasgow, who have pushed very hard. I think it's a response to crisis. I think we see a lot of drug policy reform when crisis occurs. And in Glasgow, we had a spike in HIV transmission rates amongst people who inject drugs. I think that crisis is why we're seeing drug consumption room being rolled out there. Heroin-assisted treatment, again, in Glasgow, it's a similar issue. Rest of the country, we're not seeing the same response. What we are seeing, though, is localism, ironically, work for us. So localism has destroyed us in terms of funding, but at the same time, it's given autonomy to decision-makers at local level, such as police and crime commissioners, to be innovative. So we're seeing in North Wales, for example, the police and crime commissioner there pushing for a drug consumption room. We're seeing in Durham, the police and crime commissioner and the chief constable there pushing for heroin-assisted treatment. So these innovations are coming from local decision makers, policy makers, rather than national government. That's what localism was about. It was about national government abrogating its duty and its responsibility by pushing stuff to the local area and not giving them enough money to do it. But at the same time, what it's done is created innovation.
I think the media have played its role in that as well, in that you have, I'm not honestly just on about you, Anya, but you have covered you've covered the heroin issue and heroin assisted treatment really balanced over the last few months as a broad media term. We're starting to really focus in on the human cost. And this is something I raised with you earlier, is just how your films are really balanced. You've managed to get the human stories across. Is that the way that, giving us tips, is that the way that we need to approach things, is to start thinking about how we can attach the human interest to this story?
Well, I think like any story is better told through people that have lived it rather than people that have worked in it. So if there's ever anybody with a good story, then that's the best way for us to tell that story. And every story is different, so we might be covering the same kind of issue, but it gives us a new way to kind of explore these topics. But I think going back to what you were saying earlier about cannabis not causing deaths, I think in a way, in the piece that I did looking at drug testing at festivals, the reason that they were able to get that done is because they were looking at it from a harm point of view rather than a prosecution point of view. And I think with places where people can take heroin in a sort of safe environment, I think, you know, for those that don't agree with drug taking, they can't argue against saving lives and helping people. And therefore, that's why that's been pushed more maybe than legalization of cannabis, because that doesn't kill people. And so those that are against drugs altogether won't go for the argument that, you know, cannabis is, you know, relatively safe. But, you know, when you're actually saving people's lives, people can't really argue against that.
I'm going to start to wrap up now. So have we got any more questions? I've not forgotten that, don't worry. Nigel's ignoring me completely now. See, I've had you down as a future guest, and you've not opened your mouth once. No, that's it. Blacklist now. So thank you so much, and give it up, first of all, for Emily Goddard down here. Anya Pop. And, of course, Niamh Eastwood. Thank you so much for coming, and make sure you get back safe. Thank you so much. Bye.
It's times like that that you realise that the work we do is so important, and also the part that you play in listening and sharing, it really does help. So if you could share this episode around, if you could recommend our podcast to some people that might not necessarily be involved in the conversation, it just, you know, pushes us out to realms that we don't normally get to. So thank you for the part you play in this. If you can get to live events, please do say hello. I'm always really grateful to meet listeners, so thank you so much for all you do in that. And one of my thank yous, I need to thank Tristan, our producer, who produced that one on the night, because Nicky broke his leg. So normally Nicky's at the desk, but on that particular occasion he was laid up in hospital having a bandage put on, or whatever you do with a broken leg from playing football. So thank you, Tristan and Nicky, for all you do on this. Thank you so much to My Name Is Ad for all the artwork you've done us. Amazing. Thank you, John, our Distraction Pieces Network social media guy. Please listen to the Dream Factory podcast, because John is fantastic. Also like our Facebook page at ukleap.org. And if you can follow us on Twitter at ukleap and Instagram at ukleap. And if you just want to look at our website, just have a look at ukleap.org. And as you can tell, I still do that off the top of my head and I still stumble. But one day I'll get there. I might actually be a professional one day. Yeah, might actually sound like it anyway. And I think that's it. So if you can always keep up to date with what we're doing, there's going to be more live events, there's going to be more guests, and I'm hoping to kind of put out more frequency as well. I'm hoping to do more than one a month fairly soon, because we've got quite a few in the bank now that we've recorded. So yeah, I'd like to do more. So keep your fingers crossed, we might get there. On that note, don't forget to stay safe out there, and thank you so much for listening. I'll see you again soon. Bye. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where?
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.